I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Octavius V. Cato was a leader in the desegregation of Philadelphia streetcars in the 19th century. He organized black regiments to fight for the Union during the Civil War. He founded an all-black baseball team, the Pythians, well before Jackie Robinson broke the color line. He was secretary of the Philadelphia chapter of the National Equal Rights League, and he was an advocate for voting rights and paid with his life on Election Day in 1871. He was 32 years old. Never heard of him? Well, now you will. This morning, a statue of Octavius Cato is being unveiled on the apron of Philadelphia City Hall. And joining us are Dan Biddle and Murray Dubin, whose book about Cato, published in 2010, is titled Tasting Freedom. I should add they were guests on Radio Times when that book first came out. They're former writers and editors for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Dan teaches at the University of Delaware. Murray's working on another book. And they join us once again on Radio Times to talk about Octavius V. Cato. And Dan Biddle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here, Marty.
And Murray Dubin, nice to have you with us as well.
It's wonderful to be back.
So what does this day mean to you? You had a piece in the Inquirer on Sunday about the fact that almost 150 years ago, a friend of Octavius Cato, Jacob White, really wanted to make sure that this city, this country, remembered who this was. Took 150 years. What does this day mean to you, Dan?
Well, even hearing you say those words that the statue will be dedicated today, it's almost too good to be true. When we set out on our research, we found over and over that even pretty big league historians had not heard of this man, and that in a broader sense, while scholars and descendants and a handful of people know the story of those early civil rights battles and the many men and women who fought them along with Octavius Cato. Most Americans living today don't know those stories and didn't learn them in school. And this statue, really thanks to Mayor Kenney and many others, is a great opportunity to change that.
We're going to be talking more about the statue and monuments in Philadelphia, but let me turn to you, Murray. As you write about Cato in this book, and there were others in Philadelphia, that this was really what is called the first civil rights movement, happened in the 19th century. What do we need to know about that?
Yeah, I think everyone assumes that the extraordinary men and women who led the modern civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, and many others, well, they started it. But in fact, those men and women stood on the shoulders of Octavius Cato and Henry Highland Garnett and Carolyn LeCount and Martin Delaney and dozens of others throughout the North who were involved in their own civil rights movement. And unfortunately, for an overwhelming number of Americans, they just don't know who those folks are. They've been forgotten.
And Cato, I mean, people use the phrase Renaissance man or woman to describe a lot of people, but I think Dan Biddle, we can say he was a Renaissance man.
I think so. From what we learned of his life, it was as if once he got up in the morning and went to work, he didn't enter any arena, whether it was education or equal rights on the streetcars or in politics or even in baseball, where he wasn't leading another fight for equal rights.
Could you also say that he was part of a generation in Philadelphia at this time? And it should be said that Philadelphia in the 19th century had a very substantial black population.
The largest in the country.
The largest in the country at that time. That they were part of a generation that just naturally believed in equality and access to their own rights. Dan?
To read their words and their writings from those days was very exciting for us because we having grown up in the 60s, there was an echo. These kids, Cato and his friend Jake White and his eventual fiance, a great civil rights activist, Carolyn LeCount, and others in that generation, even though their parents had been utterly deprived of education, to say nothing of political rights, they brought up their kids with this belief in education and in advocacy and in fighting the fight for equal rights. So by Civil War time, as Cato and those around him got to adulthood, they spoke as if they could change the world, and they set about to do it, and on many fronts they succeeded.
it's hard to pick in 12 minutes which part of his life to talk about, but I'm interested, Maria, in this effort to desegregate the streetcars of Philadelphia, I guess horse-drawn at that time.
Yes.
And this was the North, not the South.
Yeah, streetcars in Philadelphia start in 1859, and they're privately run. Many, many companies run the 19 lines in Philadelphia. And through the 1860s, those streetcars are used by everybody, but they are not able to be used by African Americans to visit black soldiers in hospitals, in taking training. It's just very, very hard for anyone who's African American to get on a streetcar. And basically, the thought was, if we're fighting for our country, we ought to be able to ride on the streetcars. So Caddo was one of a number of men and women who fought to get those streetcars desegregated.
And we're talking about blacks fighting in the Civil War. That was the war that they were referencing. But how were they able to do this, Dan?
Well, it was a hell of a struggle, and they fought it on two fronts. There was an early form of nonviolent civil disobedience, much like the modern civil rights struggle, in which Caddo and others, and women in particular, sat in on streetcars, defied white conductors, and there's always sort of a band of young white toughs hanging around to help white conductors throw people of color off the cars.
And you mean this literally, to throw them?
Literally. Clothing was torn, bones were broken. Lawsuits were filed. Police intervened, typically on the side of the conductors or the drivers. And yet Caddo and his allies, men and women, persisted. And at the same time, Caddo and two other young black lobbyists made trip after trip out to Harrisburg. And Murray and I keep thinking how, you know, it was an all-white legislature. And people of color didn't have voting rights yet. And these three young black men went up the steps of that big old Capitol building in those days and lobbied so persistently that by the spring of 1867, when Republicans, and this was Lincoln-era Republicans, right, very different from a lot of modern Republicans, relented and finally lined up behind a bill that would open up the streetcars and all public transportation in Pennsylvania to people regardless of race. And people who wrote about that struggle importantly said that the real winning argument was not so much moral suasion as the fact that Caddo and others had pointed out that if Republicans helped that cause in 1867, when black men got the ballot in the next few years, they would reward their friends at the ballot box and oppose their enemies.
Well, and the 15th Amendment was passed. Murray, it should be said that Caddo was a Republican, I guess, as were a lot of blacks in Philadelphia.
Yeah, the overwhelming number of African Americans in Philadelphia were members of Lincoln's party. They were Republican. They were thankful. And when they voted in the election of 1871, which was a major election with all the big offices up for a vote, the Democratic powers to be didn't want those black men to vote. So they were literally beaten up in the voting lines. Some people were killed both the night before and the day of. And Octavius Caddo, who was a major in the National Guard, walking home to get his uniform and his sword, is shot by an operative of the Democratic Party and killed.
A guy named Frank Kelly. And we are talking about gangs that were beating up black people trying to vote, or black men, I should say.
We're talking about gangs, and we're also talking about policemen.
Philadelphia police officers pulling black men out of the voting lines and beating them.
And these were what, Democrats? This was part of the city infrastructure at that time?
A lot of the police officers had gotten their jobs through this Democratic boss of those days, William McMullen, who came out of a tough background himself, was a hero to Irish Catholics who had to deal with their own many, many prejudices and forms of oppression. But McMullen openly used violence and intimidation to build and defend his political territory. And I think, as Murray said, by the time of that 1871 election, the talk of black political power was no longer just talk. Men like Caddo and hundreds and thousands of others lined up and were ready to vote and take actual power, be an actual force in a city election that year. And they'd been a bit of a force in the 1870 election, in which not as many important jobs were on the ballot. But they way out-organized the other side in 1870 and had black voters lined up by 4 o'clock in the morning. And in the writings around McMullen and the Democratic leaders of those days, you can see how by the next election they were not going to be outdone this time. And there's writings about how they had a plan to deal with a certain type of vote that was referred to in those writings as the N-word vote.
Wow. Wow. Frank Kelly, the man who shot Octavius Caddo Murray, was found not guilty.
Yeah, he escapes and is not arrested that day. Dan, I believe that there's circumstantial evidence that the police helped him, and he's basically found 6 years later. And quite frankly, whether it's today or 1871, it's hard to convict anyone 6 years later of a crime. And despite eyewitness testimony that said he was the man who shot Octavius Caddo, he was found not guilty.
Last witness for the defense was that same William McMullen, the Democratic boss, who assured the jury that probably wasn't Frank Kelly. There were a lot of white guys out on the street that day with pistols and bandages on their head.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye to you, did the work of Octavius Caddo continue after he died, Dan?
It did, although the tragedy is that by the end of the 19th century and into the early 20th, we sort of went through the birth of a nation era with what these days we would call white backlash, and the history of all those brave men and women and their handful of brave white allies sort of got taken out of the history books until the last 25 or 30 years.
Dan, I saw reference to, maybe it was even in your book, to Caddo as the Martin Luther King of the 19th century. Does that describe him? Well,
I think it's hard to compare anyone to the life of the amazing Dr. King, but there are many parallels. Both were the sons of ministers. Both led victorious fights to integrate public transportation. Both were cut down in their prime.
Right. Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us once again on Radio Times. Dan Biddle, Murray Dubin, their book is called Tasting Freedom, Octavius Caddo and the Battle for Equality in Civil War America. I should add it was published in 2010 when they were guests on Radio Times, and they are going to scurry over to Philadelphia City Hall, a statue of Octavius Caddo being unveiled this morning on the apron of City Hall. And we're going to talk more about monuments and Caddo and statues and all of that after this very short break. Gentlemen, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We were just talking about the new statue of Octavius Caddo being unveiled in Philadelphia today, which runs counter to most of the recent news about tearing down statues after the violence in Charlottesville. All of this got us thinking about who gets a statue, who doesn't, who decides, what do statues, monuments, and markers reveal about who we are, and how does history and the passage of time change how we see famous and sometimes infamous people? Think of the statue of Frank Rizzo. Our guest, Paul Farber, is Artistic Director of Monument Lab. That's a public art and history project that runs through November 19th. It's presented by Mural Arts Philadelphia, features the work of artists and art installations all around the city. Paul is also managing director of the Penn Program in the Environmental Humanities and joins us on Radio Times. Paul Farber, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, I guess the statue, the unveiling today, does raise the question about why did it take almost 150 years to get a statue of Octavius Caddo, certainly in Philadelphia. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, today is a remarkable day. In one sense, we have now a powerful installation that will be there on the apron of City Hall, dedicated to Octavius Caddo, who is a freedom fighter whose memory was carried forward by descendants, by scholars, but who was outside of the kind of bigger understandings of history in our city. And I would also say, in addition to him being present, the Caddo statue is a shift in this city. It is the first statue dedicated to a named African-American individual, person of color, on city land. And in this moment where we're thinking about representation and thinking about monuments, the long push to represent Caddo signifies powerfully in the city.
I mean, it signifies a number of things. Obviously, what took so long, but also how people get lost to history, how especially if you're a minority in this country, you're not going to be remembered like Benjamin Franklin or William Penn or all the other statues that I see in Philadelphia.
Yeah. You know, history is written in a number of ways. And of course, in addition to textbooks and historical texts, we have statues that place oftentimes individuals literally on a pedestal, whether in bronze or marble or some kind of enduring material. We get a sense of the hierarchies of history. And, you know, in this city, there are statues that punctuate so many of our public spaces. And when you look closer and you see the gaps, you see that there are, as we were saying, before today, no statues on public land to an individual African-American figure. And of course, there are a handful by the stadium on private land, like the Richard Allen statue at Bethel AME. But when you look at public land, you really see this sense of what kinds of history gets elevated and for whom.
Well, it's interesting to think of hierarchy, to think of real estate. Obviously, anything I would assume around the Municipal Services Building or City Hall, that's Center City, Philadelphia. That's prime real estate, I'm assuming, for a statue or a monument.
Yeah, that's a power spot. That is monumental in part because of the hundreds of statues that are situated around City Hall or literally put onto the building or placed on top of it. But it's also monumental because it's the central crossroads of the city.
Right.
And it's a place where people move through, stand by, and really engage civically. And I mean that in terms of getting their services, you know, serving on juries and coming to terms with what it means to be a Philadelphian.
How many, when you add them all up, and I realize we can talk monuments, statues, markers, you could go on, murals, you can go on and on and on. How many in the city? And do you know how that compares to other cities? Are we more monumental than other cities?
There are various counts. Some counts place the number of individuals who are recognized with statuary at over 1,500. I've sometimes seen that count go up to 1,700. It depends on how you count. If you include, for example, murals, historic markers, house museums, what you'll see is a kind of textbook of history written out in public space. On the building of City Hall alone, there are over 200.
Wow.
So in our city, where we have a great pride in thinking of ourselves as historical, we clearly have one of the storied public art collections in the country, if not the world. And of course, in this moment of reckoning, we're understanding whose stories are missing, especially people of color, women, LGBT people, and others who are included in these other forms of public history writing but aren't always represented in a statue or in these prominent public plazas and spaces.
Tell us what the monument, this project, the Monument Lab, what you're trying to do, or even how you're trying to change the conversation in the city about what you just said.
Yeah. Well, Monument Lab is a public art and history project produced with Mural Arts Philadelphia. And it asks a central question. What is an appropriate monument for the current city of Philadelphia?
Such a simple question, right?
Well, you know, this whole project began 5 years ago in a series of classroom conversations with myself, my co-curator Ken Lum, and many of our students. And, you know, while some people say this is quite timely now and clearly we're in this intense moment, 5 years ago we felt like we were late. We had seen years of work by artists, activists, students, really coming to terms with the status quo of monuments. And the question at the heart of this project, it took us a long time to shape it. You know, the first version of it was, what's the ideal monument? And, you know, thanks to our research director, Lori Allen, who's a librarian, she said, you know, by using the word the, you say that there's one. And of course, we know that monuments are in relationship to one another in all forms of public art. And this idea of ideal, you know, that word, whether it's ideal or it's beauty, there's a sense that there's some kind of deep logic at the heart of building monuments. And what we've tried to do is, you know, push back at, play with, and experiment with the ways that we think about monuments. And ultimately, the goal is to unearth the next generation of monuments in our city, to appreciate what we have, but unleash some creativity to reimagine and rethink as well.
Well, let me pick up on that. I went yesterday to look at the Caddo statue, and I also looked at the statue of Frank Rizzo. And next to that, and this is part of Monument Lab, is a pick. It's a hair pick, and it's maybe, what, 4 or 5 feet tall? And the
8 feet tall.
8 feet tall, and the handle is a clenched fist. Pretty close to Frank Rizzo. So what I looked at it and I walked around it and I thought, well, okay, what? There are many takeaways from this. What is the artist trying to do there?
Yeah. The artist Hank Willis Thomas has deep roots in Philadelphia. Among his grandparents were Philadelphia police and also Black Panthers. He is African American, and his mother is also the noted photo historian, Dr. Deborah Willis. And for Hank, we invited him to be a part of this project. And, you know, I love working with artists as a curator because their ideas will push you and will make you think. And he had about a handful of ideas, about 7. And we spent a lot of time walking around City Hall. And in doing so, we saw a number of different kind of manifestations of both creativity and power. In particular, the clothespin by Klaus Oldenburg was a big inspiration for Hank. Of course, you can't deny the presence of the Rizzo statue, but more so on Hank's mind was this kind of relationship of the ways that history and art can converge. And I think at that piece, what we're—
Which is called All Power to—
All Power to all, people.
All People.
Yeah, it's actually it's a quote by the late Fred Hampton. Thinking about the ways that empowerment is manifested in both public action and in public speech.
Right.
And in this particular use of public art, for the artist, he was very interested in a symbol of solidarity, of pride, of empowerment, and making something that the Afro pick, which can be bought in many drugstores and, you know, is a personal, intimate item, putting that outside as a symbol, especially for African Americans and people of color. And just one note on it, because, you know, after it's taken a long time to put it in, it's over a year in the making. And I went the other day and just saw all the fingerprints on it. And you're used to seeing that on bronze statues, the patina, when people's hands touch something that's there. It struck me at the way that though it's 8 feet tall, there's a embrace of it and a kind of contact with it that I think is important to understand as part of that in this monumental space.
Well, we had tried to do a show about the Rizzo statue. We couldn't get all the people that we wanted at that time. We'll probably pick up on it sometime later this fall. But it is interesting, its closeness to the Rizzo statue, and we know the controversy there. And I was wondering, as I was walking around, thinking, well, I wonder if it's more powerful because the statue of Rizzo is still there, but then next to it is this statue about all power to all people, and whether that's a conversation we can have.
I think it's an important conversation. I think that, you know, a lot of times when monuments are built, think a lot about the sight line. How will it command the view of someone walking up to it? But, of course, in a city context, there's multiple sight lines, and there's multiple versions of
sure.
what it means
depending
to,
on how where you
yeah.
are in.
I mean that physically, and of course I mean that, you know, in terms of your values and your visions. I think part of what makes Hank Willis Thomas's work in Monument Lab so powerful is that it's situated close, of course, to a contested statue, but mm-hmm. also in proximity to City Hall with that sight line. It's as the leaves will come down this fall, you'll see the Claus Oldenburg clothespin in relationship. And of course, whether it's the Jacques Lipschitz, you know, government of the people or the game pieces, this is a space, this is the people's space, and it's one that we've used to experiment with public art for generations. And we hope that this is another step toward understanding not just what is playful or creative, but also really important issues of social justice and solidarity that are also connected to our understanding of monuments.
We are talking about monuments, the many meanings of monuments. That's Paul Farber, artistic director of Monument Lab, again, a public art and history project, runs through November 19th in the city, presented by Mural Arts Philadelphia, and again, featuring the work of artists and art installations around the city. We've been talking about the PIC, which is on the grounds of the Municipal Services Building, rather close to the statue of Frank Rizzo. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Let me get Mike from Germantown to join us. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
The timing of the program couldn't be any better. I was coming from West Philadelphia, 41st Street over in the park, and then as your program came on, there's the statue of McClellan. And I couldn't help but think, there's another Civil War statue. But I guess the only people who are allowed to erect monuments to remember those kinds of occasions and people are the winners. I mean, we've got Abraham Lincoln, you know, by Boathouse Row. It just seems, you know, a little unfair that only the winning side gets to erect the monuments. I mean, if we had Jefferson Davis next to Abraham Lincoln and Robert E. Lee, both those people believed deeply in their cause for their state. And they lost. But they also lost personally, lost everything. And may I suggest that Reconstruction was not, under Andrew Johnson, was not the proudest moment that our country could point to in terms of reconciliation.
Mike, have you ever been to to Gettysburg, to the civil rights battlefield there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I was a little Round Top, was looking my children down where the charge had 5,000 casualties, you know, and the guy from Maine, from the 5th Maine, stopped the people from the 3rd Alabama and thought about 5,000 people, bodies there. You could have walked across that whole area from body to body. I mean, there was a heck of a price paid for that whole situation. It's actually awe-inspiring.
Well, Mike, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Paul, the reason I raise that is I've been to the Gettysburg battlefield, and you do have, and it's absolutely fascinating, statues that were erected by people whose affiliations were with the North and those with the affiliations to the South. Very different statues. The statues from the North are rather understated. The statues representing the South are much more bold and dramatic. But there they are, side by side. You know, you can drive around or walk around, and there they are.
Yeah.
It's very powerful. But it's also within the context of a battlefield, and hopefully you learn about what happened those couple of days in Gettysburg and what it all meant.
Sight matters, in, you know, immensely when it comes to monuments. That's just one of the variables. And we think about sight as a place where it's not just history happened, mm-hmm. but a lot of times we're thinking about loss and grief and challenge. And sometimes a monument will aim to heal by focusing on something that's positive. And other times, and sometimes this is with a memorial, though I think some interestingly the terms blur, it's a space where one kind of deals with trauma. You know, I think for many Americans, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. is quite powerful because it creates a space to relieve and let go. And there have been studies, it's not the battlefield, there have been studies of veterans being treated for PTSD because it's a surrogate site. And, you know, I think it's important in part to look at the different ways that monuments fit, but also what is trying to be accomplished. You know, one other note just about this notion of the Civil War and Reconstruction. During the time of Octavius Caddo's life, it was very rare, if not impossible, to find a sculpture of an African American in public space. The work of the art historian Kirk Savage in his book Standing Soldiers, Kneeling Slaves, it's terrifying in many ways to think about the struggle for representation as so deep that when we think about does a sculpture matter, does a statue hold weight, when you fought for hundreds of years to have that kind of distinction, you understand why people push so hard for sites of memory in public spaces.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And again, you can join us, as Mike did, giving us a call at 1-888-477-9499. I see a bunch of comments coming in at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Talking with Paul Farber about statues, who gets a statue, who doesn't, who decides what to statues, what to monuments, what to markers mean, what do they reveal about who we are. And I should add that in about 20 minutes, there will be the unveiling of a new statue of Octavius Caddo being unveiled on the edge of Philadelphia City Hall. And again, much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Paul Farber about monuments here in Philadelphia and what they mean. Let me get Bill from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a lot of appreciation for the program that you have right now and talking about the pick. What we call Afro pick.
Right.
What the saying was that all power to all people, that's all inclusive. So it's not just about African Americans, even though most people relate to the pick as the Afro pick and the fist raised. And as far as the Rizzo statue, I really think it would be most appropriate in South Philly. And I say that in a very positive way because, you know, when we think of Frank Rizzo, usually we think about South Philadelphia because he had a lot of connections there. I don't know if he was directly from there. But a whole lot of great Italians, you know, were in South Philly. You know, Mario Alonzo and
sure,
you know,
but he was the mayor of the entire city. I just say that, Bill.
But he was one of the very most divisive mayors, and you know, he was kind of like the Trump of his time, if you must say so, you know. And also one other thing, there's a statue, a monument, whatever you would call it, that's downtown now around the Parkway. I believe it's of all wars of African soldiers or soldiers of color. You know what statue I'm talking about?
Yep. Our guest is nodding his head enthusiastically.
That's correct.
And that was in virtual obscurity for years behind the, what do you call it, the art museum. Mm-hmm. Not the art museum, but the in Fairmount Park, in the obscure place where no one saw it for years until I think one of the African-American mayors finally decided it needed to be placed in a more high-profile place. So you're right. You know, where something is extremely important because where it was back there, I remember it, behind the Memorial Hall, it was just unbelievable. No one would see it.
Well, you know what, Bill? You raised a couple of good points, and I know our guest wants to respond to all of them. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, well, thank you, Bill, for your call and for your points. you know, we're talking about site. The location of the Rizzo statue is on the steps of the Municipal Services Plaza. You know, in fact, when you go back and read the contract language, it's not just about the placement there, but it's about the descending of the stairs. And there's something to be said about this site as a place where you go to get your city services, where you go to be able to kind of partake in your rights as a Philadelphian, and to carry with it a ongoing, not just divisiveness, but a wound. And, you know, I think it's really important to listen to especially African-Americans, women, LGBT people, about the ongoing legacies, not just of things that happened in the past, but enduring systems of injustice. One thing that is important, and thank you for bringing up the monument, or rather the memorial to the soldiers and veterans of color that is currently in Aviator Park. It was in obscurity in Fairmount Park, and you know, something that we've learned through Monument Lab, part of Monument Lab is inviting artists to answer this question with right. prototype monuments, but it also involves asking Philadelphians for their proposals, whether or not they're ever feasible. It's really about understanding ideas that could bring about the next generation of monuments. And, you know, the city has already collected, impressively so, public input about what to do with the Rizzo statue. One proposal that we've received at our at one of our labs wrote out the idea, and it broke the idea of if you should have the statue stay or go. It said, take the Rizzo statue, place it where that memorial to veterans of color was in Fairmount Park for 60 years, and then recontinue the conversation. That was just someone's idea that they carried to the Monument Lab. And so I do think that these important conversations about real estate and representation are worth having together.
Absolutely. And we will definitely do a show about the Rizzo statue once the city comes up with their plans or their ideas. Let me just pick in what you just said. Here's an email from Rick. He says, how pathetic is it that Philadelphia puts up a statue to Rocky but not to Joe Frazier? What do you make of that?
Yeah, you know, something else we're seeing throughout the creative research of Monument Lab is the story of Joe Frazier. And there is a statue of Joe Frazier that's outside of Xfinity Live in South Philadelphia.
True.
But, you know, I do think that when we parse out this, what does it mean to have sculpture on public land versus private land or real estate mattering? You know, Rocky is maybe the most famous Philadelphian.
Right? who never lived.
Who never lived. And people draw immense strength through his story. And at the same time, the mythology of Joe Frazier, an African-American boxer who people have great pride in, is pushed aside. And of course, there's room for all kinds of representations. But I do think people pick up on that. And whether it's thinking about North Philly as an important place for Joe Frazier, whether it is by, you know, other kind of places of significance, the longing for representation of Joe Frazier against Rocky does highlight for us the ways mm-hmm. that white individuals, whether they've been mythologized or they are, you know, imaginative, have been placed – their stories have been placed into public spaces mm-hmm. in bronze and marble at a dramatically higher rate than those from communities of color.
And I do want to pick up on that. Bill, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me first get Dave from Maple Glen to join us. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Hi, Marty. Great show. I wanted to say that I think a lot of these issues about, you know, the questionable people who get celebrated, like generals who committed treason in the Confederacy, or, you know, genocidal people like General Custer, they're celebrated on the argument that it's important for history, or that they thought they were doing the right thing or something like that. And I think the real solution is not to celebrate the generals, but, you know, the best model would be the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, which celebrates the grunts, the people who had to fight, maybe didn't even believe in what they were doing, but, you know, fought bravely for either a bad cause or, you know, thought they were doing the right thing. But the issue then is not so much, you know, right or wrong of the issue, but people having just done their their duty or their heroic duty and forget the generals.
Well,
and
Dave,
then we wouldn't have these issues.
I don't know. It might be too late for that, but let me see what our guest Paul Farber has to say. What do you think?
Glad that you bring up intentions, right? The road to certain monuments are paved with good intentions. And it's not a justification for not just building a monument, but to whitewashing histories, especially when they are tied to violence. So I think it's an important point that we are now taking stock of more and more. Many of the monuments that we've inherited from previous moments of conflict do elevate, in one sense, in statuary form, the generals, whether it's on horseback or another form. I think if you look deeper into the public art collection in this city and elsewhere, you will see the stories and the names of soldiers as well. One thing I would say, two important things to point out. One, again, as we were talking about representation, it's far more likely to find white soldiers represented as the common soldier than it is to find soldiers of color, despite the fact that African Americans in particular and other marginalized communities have been serving since the Revolutionary War. The other thing I want to note, and I think this is why it's important to have room for people's creativity and mark what they need to feel. The Philadelphia Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which is along Delaware Avenue, is one where there's a structure with the names of Philadelphians. It's kind of an inverse of the Maya Lin Washington, D.C. Memorial because it rises above the ground.
But as opposed to sinking into the ground.
That's correct, yeah.
Yes.
If you walk around the back of it, there's a number of other structures and plaques, but one of them is buried in the ground. And you read it. I get the chills every time I go see it, which just says that here lies the names of soldiers from Philadelphia who were represented on the wall in D.C. and their fellow comrades rubbed their names off the wall on pieces of paper and walked them back to Philadelphia and buried them at that site.
Yeah,
just
powerful.
Think how much room there is to grow and think about monuments.
Dave, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me see what Chris from Frankfurt has to say. Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Very quickly. I supervise a small rec center at 6th and Lombard, which right across from Mother Bethel Church. It's the Star Garden rec center and playground. And we have a once-a-year commemorative service honoring Octavius Cato. And I just wanted to say that when I first came into my job there as a supervisor, even before that, I was there for a little bit, I observed this ceremony. And then the next year, I looked him up. I found out more about him. I looked up his wife, and I was almost brought to tears.
It's quite a story.
It's very moving. And it took on a whole new meaning for me. And I just think that things like this can be moving, can maybe even change your outlook on things. And I'm very glad that I'm able to, you know, that we're able to honor his life and his martyrdom.
Chris, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, underscoring the fact that today the unveiling of the statue of Octavius Cato on the apron, as it's called, of Philadelphia City Hall. Anything you want to add to that, Paul?
Yeah, I share in that awe of this story, and it's a story of struggle. I think in part we are here. It's a remarkable day for the city because a Philadelphian worthy of distinction is being honored. I also think, you know, and this suggests from the caller's take, that this is a collective story. It includes the close friends and colleagues of Octavius Cato who fought to honor him by fighting for justice, but it also includes the descendants and African-American activists and students and scholars and other people from Philadelphia who for years, and you know, including our authors who were here earlier, Dan Biddle and Murray Dubin, and our mayor, Jim Kinney, this is a collective story. This is how history is written. It's not merely written by the victors. It's not merely written in short sight. It's actually a collective endeavor.
And it takes time.
It takes,
I took the word right out of your mouth.
That's correct.
We are a historic city. Do you know how many statues or monuments there are to Benjamin Franklin in Philadelphia?
I can count quite a few, at least on one hand, if not two. There's one by the Library Company. There's one at the Franklin Institute. The University of Pennsylvania's campus has at least two. Also, the writings of Benjamin Franklin are placed on and off Locust Walk, the Claus Oldenburg split button, the ghost architecture. So I could keep going.
Deservedly so, though?
I think deservedly so. I'll give an example on the north side of City Hall, where there is already a monument to Benjamin Franklin, the young craftsman. Recently, another statue to Benjamin Franklin went up across the street, featuring an embrace outside the Masonic temple with George Washington. And there's also a carving of a figure that looks like Benjamin Franklin on the facade of City Hall. I say all that to say that he's worthy of distinction, but what does it mean to have such emphasis on particular figures when other stories that have not been carved into stone and not been given prominent place are missing? I think that's part of the story as well.
But do you think we're also turning a page or starting a new chapter to think about the important role that people we've never heard of have played in the city and perhaps even the country?
Yeah. Thanks to the phrase hidden history, we get a sense, but I want to deepen it. It's not just that the history's always been hidden. It's actually that there have been active stewards of it, people who have pushed for years, if not decades, to keep memory alive, to keep it active. And what we're seeing now is a moment of intensity that, to be clear, is situated around contexts of violence and struggle. We don't take that lightly, but it's also infused with creativity, especially artists and activists and students who are reflecting on the monuments they've inherited, but also making clear that there are many ways that are urgently needed to address history as a force in the present.
Here's a tweet from Allison. After the Monument Lab is over, which is mid-November, what happens to the artwork?
Yeah. So it depends on the artworks themselves. Some of them go back to the artists. Some may linger at the site. Many of the relationships that were integral to making these monuments will remain as existing programs or projects. One, for example, there's a monument in situated outside of Marconi Plaza by the artist Shira Walensky and the collective Southeast by Southeast. It's a program of mural arts and the Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services. It's a news kiosk called Free Speech. And this is a product of 6 years of work featuring refugee and immigrant artists and writers. And like any newsstand in the city, you can go there and get postcards and writing. And that's a program that right now has a spotlight because of Monument Lab, but it will continue in important ways.
We're almost out of time here. Jacob, who had a question about is there a World War II monument in Philadelphia? There is a Pennsylvania Railroad World War II monument at 30th Street, correct?
Yeah. If you've taken the Amtrak train and you come up, you'll see a large angel figure on the side facing 30th Street. And that's in particular, it's dedicated to the Pennsylvania Railroad workers. And you'll see that. People find their way to honor those who are important to them and carry their memory forward.
Paul Farber, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Artistic Director of Monument Lab, again, a public art and history project, and it runs through November 19th and featuring the work of artists and including art installations all around the city. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us.